attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Tara Austin, behavioural science leader, Nudstop host and Rory Sutherland wrangler. Tara has been on the front line of the applied BS revolution for over a decade. With a treasure trove of experience in brand, business and behaviour change strategy behind her at Publicis and Ogilvy, she's probably best known for painting babies on shop shutters to reduce crime after the London riots. More recently, Tara's turned a psychedelic evangelist, lobbying to change the UK's approach to magic mushrooms. Tara says, how about brands start competing with each other about which one paid their taxes? How about we talk about taxes appropriately and honestly? That's a rap battle I'd like to see. Who's contributing the most in taxes and how has that contributed to achieve a world they want to see? Anyone who knows me will know how much I enjoyed sharing those words. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Thank you very much, Giles. I'm delighted to be here.
Right, seven quick fires, Tara. Mac or PC?
Mac.
Favourite gate, sort of. Margate or Ramsgate?
Ramsgate.
Hey, John Steele or Rory Sutherland?
Oh, you can't ask me to choose that. I have to say Rory.
Okay, there's a nudgy one now. Lollipops outside nightclubs or sound effects in rubbish bins?
Lollipops.
Nice. It's a Stephen Colgan one. Playful or prolific?
Oh, prolific.
Nice. Well, Old Truman Brewery or Leascliffe Hall?
Oh, Old Truman.
Oh, really? Oh, no. Oh, I'm not having that.
Well, okay. No, just because, you know, there are benefits. There are benefits.
Yeah, no doubt. I did miss Leascliffe Hall this year, though, but there we go.
Oh, yes, we did. We did miss it.
And finally, your green hat or your black hat?
Green, always.
Nice. That's meant to be a tricky one. Awesome. Nice. Well, listen, Tara, thank you so much for coming on the show. We always ask every guest about the path to where they are now. They're often quite wiggly and wonderful. So what was your first ever job? And then what was your first proper job in the industry?
Yeah, so I mean, my first ever jobs were sort of, you know, waitressing and cleaning and all of that kind of seaside town stuff in the summer holidays, which I actually think, particularly I think being a cleaner in a bar is a humbling, a worthy experience for any young person doing very kind of menial jobs and not letting your ego get the better of you early in life, I think is actually quite an important thing. I remember once having to clean up some sick the following morning in this bar that I was working in, and it turned out later in the day I found out that it was actually my friend who had been sick down the side of the sofa, which sort of made it all better. But yeah, it was really quite funny. My first job in the industry, real job in the industry was thanks to an amazing woman called Angie Moxham and Annabelle Dunstan from what was called Three Monkeys. Well, it still is Three Monkeys, but I think they've sold it. They sold it to Zeno or one of these other big PR groups. But Three Monkeys, as it was then, an independent agency, I met Annabelle in the toilets of the Green Awards in London, and I had been interning at the Ecologist magazine. If you remember that magazine, it was a green magazine way back. Zach Goldsmith was the editor. And I met Annabelle in the toilets while I was sort of covering the event as an intern. And she offered me a job and I went to go and work with a client that has been my longest standing client in many ways, the Waste and Recycling Action Programme for the government, RAP. I've worked for RAP in three different agencies in my career, and I've pitched and won pieces of the RAP business, the food waste business. I've pitched and won twice, at least. And I started, that was where my very, very first job was trying to PR anaerobic digestate to farmers, mostly farmers in Scotland, actually. I had to call up a lot of Scottish farmers and try and persuade them that they needed to start using anaerobic digestate on their fields for composting and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. So that was, yeah, my first proper job, I think.
Wow. And was calling Scottish farmers ever part of the plan growing up?
Not necessarily.
Did you think you'd even end up in this industry?
I thought I might be a diplomat,
right.
or a spy or something like that. But yeah, I think I was always maybe drawn to communications. I'm certainly an extrovert. I like talking to people. I like meeting people. And actually, now that you mention it, I was a massive, massive fan of Absolutely Fabulous from a very, very young age. I think when I was about 11, 12, it was by far my favorite program. And I always absolutely adored Patsy and have attempted in my life to sort of model myself somehow on Patsy from Ab Fab, in terms of, I loved Joanna Lumley. I loved her voice and the way she carried herself. And then somebody, yeah, pointed out to me that I've ended up being an awful lot more Adina than I am Patsy, sadly for me. But but yeah.
Oh, that's a shout out to Bubbles too.
Oh yeah, yeah, love a bit of Bubbles.
Amazing. The reason I asked that is because it's dawned on me, I think this is about episode 125 of the podcast, and very few, if anyone, that I've ever interviewed was particularly aware or had any intent to join this industry, mostly because people just don't really think about it or aren't aware. They might be aware of ads that they enjoy on telly, but they don't really think about the industry as an option to join. So it's good, because on one hand you've got that is I would say largely true, and then on the other hand you've got a lot of anxiety, understandable anxiety, from people who are looking to break into the industry, as if there's like a path that they should follow.
Oh yeah, and even it's even more weird and wonderful now, because the pathways that exist, and certainly when people ask me about getting into behavioral science, I tell them, God, there weren't any behavioral science degrees when I was studying this stuff. I mean, it's all changed. All changed, and changing all the time.
Did your like first exposure to behavioral science, was that one where you just thought, you knew immediately it was something that interested you and was something you wanted to be more involved in? Because that obviously happened via Rory, who we've spoken about. Prior to that, I think it was Mark Earls who actually introduced Rory, who I interviewed a few weeks ago. But it's always been there or thereabouts, hasn't it? It's strange. I find, as you know, we're, you know, very interested in behavioural science as an agency or as a business. And I remember making the point to someone previously, like, it's not as if behavioural science hasn't always been there. It's just that there's a much better understanding of it and a much better understanding of using it with intent, or at least applied.
Yeah, I think the language is the codification of something that we were already doing in this industry, and Rory talks more eloquently than I about A/B testing and making, sending out different kinds of coupons and understanding how to influence people, and I think he says that the first A/B test was a kind of two different kinds of coupons that were sent out in newspapers to see who responded to which ones. And so I think we've always been doing this, and we've always been trying to influence one another. It's just more recently we've started, codifying that, calling it something that makes it sound respectable and not just like we're all kind of working on hunches of how human beings behave. It's certainly changed just in the time that I've been in the industry, and I just consider myself very lucky to have kind of been at base camp. In that I was in Ogilvy as a strategist when Rory was the president of the IPA, and when the behavioral science practice was founded, And I was kind of, I just happened to be there. And I was attracted to what was going on. But at the same time, I think I found my place there almost retrospectively when I realized that some of the projects that I'd worked on that I'd had the most fun with and the most success with actually were things that I'd done that weren't necessarily advertising. So it wasn't actually the sort of the straightforward comms that was really making me excited, but other weird things that I'd been up to. One of them, I sort of, it took me years, but I was determined to tell the people at PIMS from Diageo that they needed to combine PIMS with spicy food and that there was a massive market opportunity for them, believe it or not, in spicy food. Because if you are not a beer drinker in the UK, there is basically nothing for you in an Indian restaurant. You are completely underserved. Yeah. And I did this. It took me years. I was very tenacious and it took me years to kind of track down the right clients and then get a meeting. And I put together this whole great big strategic deck and ended up running this little experiment we called Pucker PIMS. And proving, in fact, that there was a great market opportunity, something that Diageo have never fully activated. And I still think there's a big opportunity out there for somebody to pair off a drink with Indian food that's not beer. It's a big market opportunity. But it was one of these things that made me, that and a few other little projects I'd run that made me realize that actually where I really wanted to be was in the consultancy and the behavioral science practice and working in a very media agnostic way, where just looking at business problems and looking at how to influence people and how to make things happen that weren't happening. And of course, the Babies of the Borough was a big part of that, which again was more like just problem solving. And it all came about because I used to read The Grocer magazine, which everyone in the department used to laugh about. So they'd put it on my desk and, you know, it always had headlines like big month for cheese, you know, this kind of thing. And so they always used to tease me about it, but I worked on a lot of FMCG goods at the time, Unilever, I was on Comfort and Hellman's and that kind of thing. And as a brand strategist. And then the riots happened and I just happened to read the editorial the week after where the editor was saying, look, it's not good enough that we're not allowed to install shop security shutters. We need to protect our greengrocers, obviously in the light of everything that happened. But I had this little insight into not just the planning process, but the town planning process and how difficult it was to install shop shutters because they make areas darker, which is not something I'd ever considered because the light is not reflected off the glass. And, you know, there was this sort of insight into how difficult it is and it made me reflect on how much these shop shutters are a visible signal of the presence of crime in an area, but something that is very much, sort of subconsciously felt, if you like, signaled. And I had this moment of matching that up with the artwork of a guy called Ben Ein, who had moved to my hometown of Hastings and had painted the seafront with these lovely, great, big, beautiful letters on the shop shutters down there. And he'd done the same thing in Hackney. And I sort of thought, well, these are big, relatively flat media surfaces that could be used for messages. How about we try and invert the meaning of these shutters? How about we try and improve upon them? And I still, to this day, believe there is a massive opportunity across the country. And if any brand is listening to this, take it up. There's somebody out there who could, you know, transform some town centres for very little money, very, very little investment, and make a real difference to how people feel about an area. And of course, yeah, that thought ended up, that was just as we were launching the behavioural science practice. And so, Jez and Rory at the time said to me, why don't you go up at the launch event we did the launch event on, it was a leap year day. And so you know that on leap year, a woman is allowed to propose to a man and all this stuff. So we kind of themed it around marriage and commitment. And as a, you know, commitment device is being important in behavioral science. And so their commitment device was to get me to stand up at the launch and tell everybody that I was going to do this experiment, painting the faces of local babies onto shop security shutters to see if we could bring down antisocial behaviour following the London riots. And then it worked in that it did commit me to it. And I made it happen with the help of an amazing woman called Nicole Yershin, who ran the Ogilvy Labs, as they were called at the time, the kind of R&D function for Ogilvy. And Nicole backed it and really, she's a, you know, incredible woman who just is a dynamo and makes things happen. And yeah, together we went and did that. And somehow the creatives involved entered it into a load of awards, which I thought was ridiculous at the time because it was such a small experiment and it was so tiny. But it did, it got a lot of attention. And I think that's really the power of some of these behavioral science led ideas, is that when you tap into particularly universal human insight, like our love of babies, for example, and cuteness and how that matters to the brain. But also, you know, the famous Schiphol fly in the urinal type. These are universal things that are psychologically interesting and they get quite a lot of traction because of that and they travel very well. And so we had quite an interesting case and won a lot of awards, won a Cannes Lion. I mean, I sort of peaked very early with that. It was the first, you know, it was the pretty much the first thing I'd really done. I was junior planner at the time, I think, and suddenly I had a Gold Lion. So it was quite a ride, yeah.
So well articulated. And I want to go on record, so I'm always happy for people to plug Nick Yershon because she's an absolute gem. And funny enough, I was going to ask you about Nudgestock. And last time I saw Nick was, I spent half the day of the most recent Nudgestock with Nick Yershon. And I was going to ask you, how has Nudgestock played a kind of role in that time in your career? Because we were talking before we started recording about when we first met, which was at one of the very first Nudgestocks at Leascliffe Hall. But at the time, I mean, I appreciate Nudgestock is a mouthpiece of sorts for Ogilvy itself, but it's also a celebration of behavioural science, right? And it's the celebration of it that's made it always so interesting and like such a great event to go to.
Yeah, I mean, we doff the cap and bend the knee for our Ogilvy overlords, of course we do, but we do see the event as exactly that. It's the world's biggest festival of behavioral science and creativity. And I think, you know, the Ogilvy-ness allows us to marry up the geekery at the heart of our practice in behavioral science and academia with, you know, thinking and craftsmanship that is hopefully taking the world forward and is beautiful and is immersive. And this year we were delighted to have Dr. Paul Zak presenting his work on immersion in the brain how he's got this amazing technology, frankly, that can track levels of oxytocin and dopamine and these powerful neurotransmitters and how he can, through those neurotransmitters, infer how immersed in an experience you are, how much you are kind of almost in the flow state of not just giving it your attention, but actually you're in the moment with this experience and you're valuing it, you're kind of loving it maybe. And he did say, because we tested the tech at the event, that our conference was the most immersive conference that he had tested. And that was a real hit. You know, we loved to hear that. It was the first time we'd been back in hybrid and, you know, had a real life event this year. Since the pandemic, and it was really important to us that it was a celebration, that it was fun, that it was speaking to our system one bodies and brains, and really, yeah, delighting people and surprising them and stimulating them. I think I must have said stimulate about 200 times on the day. but yeah, that's really our intention.
And force the man into an ice bath.
Yes. There's always, I think, every year one of my colleagues gets a sort of standout performance in there, and this year it was definitely Nick Dockyer in the ice bath. That was for sure. Yeah, wonderful stuff.
Obviously, and you know, quite rightly, Nudstock has become, you know, much was just significant as an event versus how perhaps it wasn't in the first few years, just from an awareness perspective at least. Have you got any favourite memories from, like, I suppose, the archive years of talks? Because I still remember and talk about a brilliant talk that was given on the board game. Was it Andrew Shearing on his board game, The War on Terror?
Oh, wow, yes.
2017. Was that 2017? Right,
I think
okay.
So,
it was all
yeah.
blur into one.
Or maybe it was 16. It could have been 16, but I think it was 17. That's a fantastic, fantastic example of the kind of the lateral power of Nudstock to really make you think and put people in front of you that you're never expecting, and yet can provoke some deep thinking about lots of different kinds of categories and worlds. And yeah, certainly a big hits for me. I think the one that was most influential in my life story was actually Dave Trott talking about Edward de Bono in, I think that was 2016. I could get that wrong, but I think it was then. That changed the course of my life because I subsequently went on to really much more thoroughly investigate de Bono and lateral thinking techniques, and I got trained up in as a trainer of trainers. So I'm allowed to kind of certificate people as a trainer of de Bono's lateral thinking techniques. There are many others. I mean, the one that we're not almost not allowed to talk about is the Dominic Cummings. That was 2017. That's well worth a watch if you haven't seen it already. And actually, bizarrely, that also changed my life. Now that I think about it, it also changed my life because I subsequently met him in 2020. And I wonder, I hadn't really reflected on that, but I think maybe I wouldn't have met him if he hadn't spoken at the conference. So Nudstock put me in his path, I suppose. And actually, that was an extraordinary event in my life, where it was the middle of the pandemic, and Dominic asked me to come into number 10, and he actually asked me if I would consider being the Prime Minister's spokesperson, would you believe, which was the craziest day of my life. And I said no, because I wasn't about to fall on Boris's sword anytime soon, but I did say I'd go and work for the government if he wanted me, and I had been planning on doing that until he was then sort of out of number 10. But that meeting was far more influential than I ever imagined it would be in the course of my life, because I did something which seems extremely unwise in that meeting. In retrospect, it seemed even at the time completely bonkers, and I thought, what are you doing, you crazy woman? But Dominic and I had quite a long conversation about evidence-based government, which is something that I believe in, and the establishment of the data science unit that he was setting up. And I said to him, how much do you know about psychedelic medicine? And he said, not very much, go on. And we had quite a chat about the potential of psychedelic medicine to transform society. And I said, I know you think that the next great innovation, he's always looking for the, you know, the kind of DARPA-esque invention of the internet, that kind of thing. I said, I know you're looking for this sort of technology that will save the world, but I'm telling you that the next great social innovation is not something you hold in your hand. It's going to happen inside us, and in the same way that the pill or vaccination, these kinds of technologies, if you like, organic technologies in our lives, have actually shaped our world in really profound ways that we cannot see necessarily, but are there. I said psychedelic medicine is going to do the same thing, and it's not just going to help us with the mental health crisis in our country, it's actually going to treat trauma that leads to all kinds of social ills. It's going to treat the trauma that leads to domestic violence or obesity or, you know, all these other knock-on impacts from treating people's mental health. I said, this is, we've got a medicine and now I advocate for psilocybin, which is the psychoactive compound in magic mushrooms. I do that having gone down a path that really started in the cabinet room in number 10 with Dominic Cummings and probably started at Nudgestock before that. So
it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was influential in my life.
I wasn't going to try and like force a link between creativity in the lateral kind of thinking world and psilocybin magic mushrooms world, but just by pure chance, I was watching a Netflix documentary with my two young daughters who are 6 and 7 the other day. We're not too strict on telly, but when we watch telly, we like it to be at least vaguely educational. And this was all about a train of thought that does exist at quite a decent scale, that magic mushrooms and psilocybin specifically played a significant role in man's evolution.
Ah, the stoned ape hypothesis.
The acceleration of the kind of brain size and capacity. And it was absolutely fascinating. Now, I don't know how seriously that's taken as a train of thought, but it was fascinating nonetheless. And I could see there being sufficient amount of evidence to suggest it wasn't just a, you know, batshit crazy idea.
Well, I think that what's interesting is that in the last few years, the stigma around psychedelic medicine has so significantly lessened. In the time that I've been campaigning, it has dramatically changed. And even sort of, there was a backbench business debate that we were pushing for in May this year. And even since May, I'd say the media environment, the environment that we deal with MPs and the sort of stigma around these medicines has really dramatically shifted. And the benefit of that is that theories like the stoned ape hypothesis, which is this idea that the very, very fast and kind of otherwise really inexplicable development of man's cognitive function over the space of, I don't know, just a few thousand years, I think it sort of doubled in size. Our brain just rapidly grew in a very short space of time. There is this theory that psilocybin mushrooms had a role to play in that. And what I was going to say is that in lessening the stigma, we are finally starting to see these theories for what they are, which is very real possibilities. But if I was talking to you about this 5-10 years ago, or when, I think it's Terence McKenna who developed the hypothesis, when it was first developed, you could have laughed it out and said this was batshit crazy because of the bias against psychedelics that existed. Now we can say, right, we're never going to know for certain unless we try and replicate this experiment somehow on the savannah. But we can see in a very objective sense that early man was, you know, hunter-gatherer. We're on the plains of Africa or wherever, and we're certainly hunting cattle and following cattle. And one thing we know about psilocybin mushrooms is that they feast on cattle dung. That is their very, very favorite form of food. And where you find cattle dung, eventually you will find psilocybin mushrooms. It's almost inexplicable that our early ancestors wouldn't have tried psilocybin mushrooms. And if they had, they would have invariably seen, well, they would have experienced something very, very, very strong, very profound, and potentially very, very helpful. Whether that meant that they felt at one with the animals that they were hunting. And we see even now in the tribes of South America, we see the ayahuasca, very powerful psychedelic medicine that is primarily consumed by these tribes in order to be at one with the Amazon, to understand the jungle. In fact, in the recent rescue of those poor children in the plane crash in the Amazon, the rescuers credited what they call the grandmother ayahuasca with advising them to go back to the crash site and look again. The rescuers actually undertook a ayahuasca ceremony, I think the night before they found the children, precisely because these indigenous populations really believe that they can commune with the jungle and with the animals. And so it seems remarkable that our ancestors wouldn't have consumed these mushrooms, and that potentially there would have been a great benefit to them in doing that. But we also know that these mushrooms facilitate connection and connectivity in the brain, the kind of connectivity that allows for synesthesia, which is where our different senses cross over one another. So people will very regularly describe experiences where they might see a piece of music, or or taste a color, or where words have emotions attached to them. And actually the interesting thing is that the basis of all language is synesthesia, is making a sound into a meaning. We often in the behavioral science practice talk about something called the Buber and Kiki effect, and you might be familiar with this, where if I were to show you a big, fluffy, round, cloud-like shape and a spiky shape side by side, and I said, which one is Buba and which one is Kiki? 98% of people on planet Earth, no matter where they come from or what language they speak, would tell me that Buba is the round shape and Kiki is the spiky one. And that's because the sounds that we hear and the shape that we're making with our mouths is something that we are associating together with something that is textural. We're building all of these associations that they are not arbitrary. They are meaningful, and that is kind of the basis of all language that we have, is that kind of synesthesia. So the idea that the ancient man would have consumed psilocybe mushrooms and developed the capacity for language. We know that psilocybe mushrooms also encourage neurogenesis, or there is some evidence in rat studies, I should say, that shows neurogenesis, the development of the dendrites of the neurons of the brain. I think psilocybin is perhaps one of the only things we know of on planet Earth that can grow the brain. And there is all kinds of amazing research happening in terms of traumatic brain injury and declining cognitive function. And if you're listening to this and you think you've got either of those two things, then I would heartily encourage you to start looking at the evidence around psilocybe mushrooms. But, the idea that our brains as a species grew so dramatically, and that we formed, the basis of all culture and civilization, which is the language that we're speaking right now, in a very short space of time, there's nothing to say that the stoned ape hypothesis isn't correct. And I think it's certainly worth considering in the light of day, away from the mad and frankly very incorrect propaganda of the 1970s, which said that all these psychedelic drugs were just sort of going to fry your brain and that they were wrong somehow. Our ancestors have been consuming them for as long as we've had ancestors, frankly.
Yeah, you've said, I read in the research that it's been controlled since 1971, but crucially without any real shred of evidence to suggest it wasn't beneficial. So it's designated as a Schedule 1 substance, which I wasn't familiar with before, but it implies that there's no medical value whatsoever, which seems absurd, not least because a few months ago I spoke to a couple of brilliant women who run psilocybin workshops in Holland, to great effect, with all sorts of business leaders. So where are you at with this mission that you're on?
Where are we at? Well, we've been campaigning. We only really formally formulated our volunteer team. We call ourselves PAR, which is for psilocybin, very inconveniently begins with a P, but sounds like an S, but psilocybin access rights. And we believe that we are fighting for what is a universal human right, and that this is a civil rights movement. This is the next sort of civil rights movement, if you like, that we should have the right to our own consciousness and the right to treat our mental health, certainly, and our physical health, the ways that we choose to. And where we are is we've been campaigning. I've been working on this since, 2020. We kind of formally launched as a public campaign just last year. And we've just had an International Magic Mushroom Day just in September. And we raised a little bit of money, which is not something we'd done much of before. And that is to launch what we're calling Project Croydon. Project Croydon sounds like something dreamed up by Del Boy. We're very conscious of that. But our intent is to make things a little bit more uncomfortable for Chris Philp. And he is the drug minister in the Home Office who's responsible for the scheduling of psilocybin. As you mentioned, the scheduling is not the whether or not it's not the classification. So there's two things under law, the classification and the scheduling. The classification is what happens if you have a substance on the street, whether or not the police can take it off you, how long they lock you up for, that kind of thing. So there's A, B, C, D. People are familiar with that. But the scheduling is whether or not a licensed professional is allowed to access a substance. And it goes sort of 1, 2, 3, 4. And schedule one is the most restrictive area. And it says, as you say, there is no known medical benefit and the high potential for abuse. Now, neither of those two things are true of psilocybin. There is absolutely no evidence and no reason that psilocybin should be in schedule one. And the rest of the world is waking up to that. So Australia earlier this year rescheduled psilocybin, brought it into schedule two. And this means that researchers, academics, medical professionals will be able to access it. Much in the same way that, heroin is a class A drug, but it is a schedule two substance because every hospital pharmacy carries morphine. It is a medicine and you damn well want it if you break your back or something. It's required, it's needed, and we need this. So we're fighting for this, and Project Croydon is our next attempt at putting a bit more pressure on the minister. We're hoping to kind of make it an issue in his own backyard. So we know that we've done various things over the last couple of years. We've had government petitions. We've had the UK's first psychedelic ad campaign earlier in February this year, and now our intention is to try and focus our energies on the good people of Croydon South and to make them the best informed people in the country as a sort of population about the potential benefits of psilocybin and to encourage them, where possible, to go into Chris Philp's surgery on a weekly basis and tell their minister, because he is still their local MP, that they want this and that they need it and that their wives and children and husbands and aunties and uncles need this because we all do. And so we're hoping, to kind of put a bit more urgency under Chris. There's a kind of belief at the moment that maybe the UK is just waiting for America and the FDA to market authorize psilocybin. But frankly, we should not be waiting. There are people who kill themselves every day in this country, frankly, needlessly. I mean, we're not doing enough to help them. We're not doing enough for our veterans, for people who have alcohol problems in this country. There are huge swathes of the population that we, as a society, almost write off, and we sort of go, well, they're on the scrap heap of life because they're too traumatized. Too much has happened for them to be productive members of society. And it's simply not true. They can get their joy back and they can get their health back. And I've seen too many miracles now not to want to push this and to push it as hard as I possibly can and to spread the word at every opportunity I get to tell people that this medicine even exists. I do that because I feel at the moment that I'm very much in a elite. The psychedelic elite is very real, and there are plenty of people in this country who can fly to Jamaica or can go to Amsterdam and can experience psychedelic medicine therapeutically to great effect. But the man on the street in the UK who's got a tobacco addiction and cannot give up cigarettes, that is killing him, has no idea this even exists and has no idea that we've got the kind of data that we have, which is showing, you know, in some cases, it's up to 80% success rates for one treatment, not even a capsule or drug that you put in your mouth every day to numb your depression, for example, but one-off treatments that are enormously powerful in healing people from the things that ail them. And yeah, and I've seen it, and it is miracles that we're talking about.
How can people support Project Croydon then?
They can go online to our website, which is par.global, P-A-R.global. And there's a variety of ways. So we've been doing an awful lot of letter writing. We sent out 550 letters just the other day to MPs, backbench MPs, encouraging them to take up this fight. There are I want our politicians to be ahead on this. I mean, I'm foolhardy in that respect, in that this medicine is going to come into people's lives anyway, that the evidence is gathering at such a pace that the rest of the world is already waking up and that it will come here. But our challenge is it's not going to happen quick enough for the people that we're going to lose in the meantime. And the other challenge with that is that in the meantime, there are a lot of desperate people who will seek to self-administer in unsafe situations. So whilst I am a wholehearted believer in the power of these medicines, I also completely recognise that they are very dangerous. They're dangerous in the wrong hands. They're dangerous if you have a group of vulnerable people. There are always going to be bad people that will try and exploit that. And I'm really clear that the reason that we're pushing our MPs to understand these medicines first and foremost, understand how they work, is to protect these vulnerable populations and make sure that we can not only get access, but safe access. Because it's not as simple as putting something in your mouth. You absolutely have to be in the right, what they call set and setting. So you need to be in exactly the right environment, a therapeutic environment for these medicines to work. And you need to be with somebody who can guide you through that experience. It's not to say that, you know, nobody could successfully take these medicines in their own ways. And certainly I'm the last person to say I want to, you know, come down on that. But what I want right now is for our politicians to get ahead so that people aren't taking them in unsafe ways out of desperation, because I think we're going to see otherwise. I'm quite scared about the potential for people to do that, because this is not a medicine that you need to even get over the internet on the black web or anything. Anybody can grow this. It grows in the fields right now in September, October. This is growing throughout our country and throughout most of Europe. And anyone can grow this stuff on top of their wardrobe as well. So there's nothing to stop anyone from already consuming it. And they can be dangerous. They can be traumatizing if taken in the wrong way. And so we're really keen that we want that system set up to help people safely consume these medicines therapeutically. And I just think back to when the internet first came around, right? My dad founded like one of the first internet service providers in the country. Didn't get a penny out of it. I wish we were loaded, but he did do that. And he believed that the internet was the future. And I remember in those early days, nobody had any idea what it was. And I believe that our MPs have an obligation to see the future and to know what's coming, and to look to these new technologies and see the potential. I mean, for heaven's sake, it took coronavirus for us to be able to have online consultation with our doctor. You know, this is when you're infectious, they used to ask you to go into a practice. I mean, it took coronavirus for that to happen in 2020, and we'd had this technology for so much longer. But equally, I think along the way, there was a lot of there's been a lot of bad stuff that's happened. And I remember my father saying to me a long, long time ago, you know, all they need to do is make the internet service providers responsible for the traffic, and tell them we'll lock you up if there's child pornography or if there's God knows what else, you know, all of this violent, terrible content. If that's being hosted on your servers, you're going to prison. And he said, like, they don't seem to understand that this stuff isn't in the ether. It's in copper wires and it's in metal and it's in, you know, real places. But I think that the fact that our MPs were so behind on understanding both the potential of the internet, but also the dangers of all of it, the cyberbullying, all of that kind of stuff that came along with the birth of the internet. I just really feel that our MPs ought to be ahead of it. So, sorry, back to your question, which was, how can people help? Yes, you can tell your MP, you can write to your MP. We've got all sorts of stuff you can do there. You can come to Croydon, leafleting, you can give us advertising space, you can donate. You can donate all kinds of things. We just had an art auction where we donated donated art. You can share our message on social media. You can follow us and join our newsletter, and there'll be other ways that you can support. And you can come and be a part of the campaign. We are entirely run by volunteers. None of us are paid for what we do. We do it for a love of the medicine and a belief that this is the future of our society. And it's honestly, that it's the one thing that gives me hope, because we are looking at a planet that is burning, and I'm very heavily pregnant at the moment with my first baby, and you know, I want the world that he grows up in to be a better place than the world is now, but there is hope, and it's in the form of a mushroom.
Brilliant! That's what, so well said, Tara.
Do get your children to watch Fantastic Fungi. If you're at all interested in this sort of area, there's a film, it features a guy called Paul Stamets, who is the world's leading mycologist. It's on Netflix. It's a very, very beautiful film. And it's not about psilocybin mushrooms. It's about all mushrooms. Psilocybin mushrooms feature. But it's really about the mycelial network under the forest floor, under the earth, and how the mycelial network, how it is that mushrooms and fungus connect plants, how they allow plants to communicate and transfer nutrients between different plants. It's a really very, very beautiful and very educational film. I think everyone, all of humanity should watch it at some point, but you certainly your children should find it interesting, hopefully.
Funny enough, that was the documentary I was referring to.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. Fantastic. And how it just connects all manner of life.
Yeah.
Just fascinating.
And the whole cycle of life and death, you know, we're very much dependent on this stuff that we don't see. They call it now the wood wide web, but it's been there all along, and we've taken it for granted, yeah.
Time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast as we thought your ears had suffered enough of the monotone ramblings of the host. Now this is a voice.
Ha, 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 ha.
Most pods drop an ad into these interruptions, not gasp. We won't awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards, on 01189 952 007 to talk brand identity or positioning like other companies did just the other week. Let's get you back to the show.
Bollocks in today's world, bollocks matters. It is all about bollocks.
Ah, the legendary agency holding company CEO, George Tannenbaum, from Call to Action episode 46, not what we were looking for.
I'm going to move to our listener questions, Tara.
Okay.
So, asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. I've lifted two off LinkedIn. I'm slightly mindful you may have seen these, but I'm going to go with them anyway. So, sticking with the topic, Simon Robinson asks, what was the best professional insight psychedelic substances have offered you?
It's actually very easy. That my ego is not necessary for the development of whatever it is I'm doing. Basically, when I was a younger woman, I suppose professionally, you know, as a strategist, you come up with an idea, you refine it, you think it's as good as it can be, and you present it to people. And the tendency is when you share it with others, when they critique it, the tendency is to defend and not really hear what that criticism is or means. And I've got a very, I've succeeded as a strategist because I'm very good at defending my thinking. But I realized that most of the time, you know, when people are criticizing an idea or a piece of work, they aren't criticizing you. And they aren't saying this, you are bad at your job, or, you know, there's some fault with you. Generally, they are actually talking about the idea. And you have to separate those two things. And I think it's made me a better manager of people. I think it's made me a better thinker, in that I have built in more flexibility of thought. I think I really value the ability to change my mind and to bring new evidence to the table that then changes the situation, and to evaluate that new evidence in the cold light of day. We often talk in the behavioral sciences about, you know, sunk cost fallacy, and how people are very bad at abandoning ideas that they've already invested heavily in. And I like to believe that I'm pretty good at sort of not throwing good money after bad and saying, actually, no, the situation has changed. Let's evaluate it afresh. And what does that mean for us? I like to, and I think that's been a big help to me professionally. Putting my ego to one side. Not easy, but it definitely, psychedelics have definitely helped with that.
That's really, really good. Really good. Question two is from Will Humphrey, and Will asks, what piece of writing, industry or not, has most influenced you over the past 2 to 3 years?
I think one of the most influential pieces of writing in my life, but it's not in the last couple of years, but I can certainly recommend it, would be Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind. And it's interesting because Haidt is one of the only living legends that we haven't had at Nudgestock, which is something that needs to be corrected, in my humble opinion. Yeah, Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind, how he talks about the foundations of morality and moral foundations theory, what he calls moral foundations theory. I think that has shaped my understanding of politics and human interaction more than anything else. I wouldn't directly attribute it to my business life, but certainly how I think about, we do a lot of personality profiling at Ogilvy, and increasingly we look at cultural cognition and how people, which is looking more at moral foundations theory, to be honest, is going more into that path of how do people understand the world, and when we're doing work on things like say vaccine hesitancy is a perfect example of where you need to understand someone's relationship with hierarchy and authority. How communitarian are they? How much is fairness important to them? In order to shape the right message that is going to influence whether or not they will take the vaccine. So, there's some interesting stuff. I'd like to explore that more at Nudgestock one of these years, actually.
No doubt. Well, you need to get Jonathan Haidt there for sure.
Yeah, Jonathan Haidt, he needs to be there, definitely.
Tara, the final part of the interview is our four pertinent posers, starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
So, the Oracle at Delphi is very well known for having this message, know thyself, right? Written above the door in stone. And but what is less known is that there are two other maxims. So it was know thyself, nothing to excess, and surety is ruin. And I think with my youngest, for me, the psychedelic movement actually captures all of those three things. Like, you know, actually do it. You know, if you need to, go and find out what it is that ails you. Like, most people don't really know what drives their depression, in my view, and psychedelics do give you that access. So know yourself, nothing to excess, you know, give up the fags or whatever, and, you know, try not to drink too much. But actually, again, psychedelics have really taught me more than anything else, surety is ruin. The more attached you are to anything, and the more certain you are about something, the more it will be your undoing. And we have to be more flexible in our thinking about our lives, about our futures, about who we are, if we really want to surf the wave of life and get as much joy out of it as we possibly can. So I think I would, those three maxims are the things that I would encourage my younger self to live by, and not to be so attached to anything or any idea of who I was, because certainly my life has not played out the way I expected it to, and that is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
all the better for it, no
yeah,
doubt.
Yeah, definitely. Nice.
That's awesome. Great answer. Number two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
The big egos. And I'm not a big fan of open plan offices. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the connectivity, but my God, we need more like privacy and booths and private phone calls and meetings. And oh my God, this our obsession with not having any desks, I think, goes against everything in human nature. You know, people like to know where they're going to sit, you know, so like that's another thing. It looks good, but, you know, build for human beings, I would say. and actually our physical environments are really important to how we conduct our lives, so, and how we live. So, but yeah, that and the big fat egos can go.
I can do one. We've already had The Righteous Mind, but are there any other books that you can recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, the one that I always recommend to people, it sounds very soft, it's called Falling in Love with Where You Are by a man called Jeff Foster. And this is because it's a beautiful book. It's written it's divided up into chapters that are the months of the year. And what I find incredibly useful about this is that if I find myself in a moment of panic or disquiet or trouble, struggle, suffering, whatever it might be, I can turn to that month and just read a couple of pages from this book, and I find his words enormously soothing. And the interesting thing about Jeff is that he has no desire to be a guru. He's a sort of anti-guru in the way that he talks about life, but he is he gives me enormous reassurance that everything in this moment, here and now, is okay. And that actually all I really need to do in those moments of struggle is to come back to the present. And I think he has this line in his book where he says, he talks about gratitude for what is right now, you know, what exists and what has not yet been taken away. And I just think in the changing, our lives are going to change so much from even by the time this podcast kind of goes out, who knows what could have happened to me, my family, everything. And yeah, we struggle so much on a daily basis. And I see so much of it with the mental health kind of world and campaigning that I'm doing. There's so much struggle out there and so much suffering. And actually, a lot of it, we have the power to bring ourselves back into the present moment and appreciate it. And he really is, more than anyone else I've ever read, masterful at making you realize the truth of what really matters. And so I encourage anyone to read that book and to grab a copy, because it's well worth it.
It sounds great, and I'm particularly pleased because it's definitely never come up before in 125,
yeah,
and that's increasingly rare, right? That's brilliant.
But you know what? It's out there in Adland, because I've probably bought it for at least, probably five or six colleagues and friends who work in this industry, because actually it's an industry that's rife with burnout and grief and loss and, you know, overexertion and bullying. And I've been there, and I've done a lot of that stuff, And it's hard, and it's hard on your soul. And I think historically we've been thought of as an industry that doesn't have much of a soul. And sometimes you see people who become very, very cynical about their own industry. And I struggle with that. Like when I've worked with kind of creatives who basically poo-poo what they do, I think, you know, why are you here? Because actually, even if you're making you might be making an advert for mayonnaise. But if you're bringing some joy into the world and selling a great product, I believe in capitalism. And I believe in capitalism evolving towards something that is better and better and better. And I think I've seen that already in my lifetime, the nature of the products are kind of coming through in the way of living. We've got a lot further to go, and we need massive political change. Don't get me wrong, like bloody hell, a lot needs to happen. And I also think psychedelics can help us with that reprioritization. But, you know, I also believe that the human species is evolving towards something better, and that we can make our products better and we can make our lives better. And actually, you know, if you want to make advertising for mayonnaise, make it something that brings people joy as well. And yes, sells a great product, sells a better product than the other product, hopefully. And, you know, don't sell cigarettes and don't sell gambling and, you know, a few other things. But like, you can still take joy out of your work and give it to others. And I think that's really why we're here. And I think it's very, very sad when people get so cynical about our industry that, you know, that they're not experiencing the joy. They should go and do something else.
there's also, I mean, that side you've touched on there about the, almost a sense of shame about doing something that helps sell mayonnaise. And there's a line I've quoted before, so I won't do it again, but it's a line from Steve Harrison when he talks about commercial purpose, and that in selling that mayonnaise, not only will the, you know, original creator of that mayonnaise get paid, the person who runs the shop where the mayonnaise is sold, the people who clean the shop after it's closed, they'll be able to pay, you know, they'll be able to put food on the table. Like, there's a whole chain of consequences from capitalism, and we needn't be ashamed of it. And then it becomes a moral decision, right? Like you just said there, like gambling or tobacco, whatever it is. But yeah, no, you're totally right, Tara. Well said. And then lastly, Tara, number four, we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest. So would you kindly dedicate this episode?
Yeah, I've got a little, maybe a trilogy, or maybe there's four. It's a bit cheeky, but if I could have Amanda Fielding, Professor David Nutt, Rick Doblin, and Paul Stamets, I think they would be my... those four are my heroes in terms of they've all campaigned for in different ways for psychedelic medicines for many years now, and they've spoken the truth to power. In the case of Professor Nutt, he was the government's drug czar, and he lost his job for just saying that taking ecstasy was less dangerous than riding a horse in a student lecture, because it is, and that was the data that he was presenting. But you know, he's an amazing man. Amanda Fielding has been a campaigner her whole life long. They call her the Queen of Consciousness, and she really is an extraordinary woman who I don't think gets enough credit for the work that she's done with the Beckley Foundation to invest in and fight. She found the money. She got other people to give her the money to set up the Beckley Imperial Center for Psychedelic Research, on which, you know, this whole new generation, new wave of research has kind of predicated. Working with Professor Nutt in the US, it's Rick Doblin who's been leading MAPS, and as I already mentioned, Paul Stamets, the world's leading mushroom man. You know, those guys, they're all I just think, wow, like everything that we're doing now to try with PAR to try and push this agenda, it couldn't happen if it weren't for their work in the face of a lot of stigma. And so I really admire all of them, and I think each of them should get the sort of Nobel Peace Prize, actually, for the kind of investment that they've made, their life work in evidence-based science and in following these medicines where they can take us next. I hope one day that will actually happen.
Excellent, excellent dedication. So that's Amanda, Professor David Nutt, Rick and Paul.
Yes, that's right.
Brilliant. So as a final call to action, we're going to link to everything we've discussed, from the Netflix film Fantastic Fungi to Nudstock's channel for the 2023 event, all of the books that you've plugged, Falling in Love with Where You Are, and of course The Righteous Mind. Oh, and Pardot Global, of course, too. How else can our listeners get more Tara Austin?
Of course, of course. Well, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of me on Nudstock. Well, and you know, come see us at Ogilvy if you've got a brief, if you've got some wonderful piece of work you want us to do. And as consultants, we're available. I'm in this. I have this kind of joint life now, I think. And the amazing thing is that all the work that I do in my day job for the behavioral science practice is about how we really influence system one and the deep subconscious and the highly evolved brain, and, you know, and the behavioral sciences is really all about that, how we treat human beings, how we understand the human being. And as I'm very fond of saying to my colleagues, the work that I do for PAR is actually about the same thing. It's about, but the difference is that psychedelic medicines allow you access to system one. And so whilst on one side I might be making a campaign to encourage people to stop smoking for Ogilvy, on the other side, I'm trying to get people to help, you know, I'm trying to help people get access to psilocybin to stop them smoking on a one-to-one basis. So they're very much, these two worlds are seemingly very different, but actually totally aligned. And I've been thinking, actually, I might need to try and write some kind of book about psychedelics and behavioral science. So if anyone's got any ideas, I think I need to. I've got a few thoughts on psychedelic thinking and how the two things are very much aligned. But yeah, I need to kind of formulate that. So maybe there'll be a book in the future. Who knows?
Nice. We'll get you back on to launch it.
Mm-hmm.
This has been Ace, Tara. I've had a brilliant time. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. Thank you for having us. Thank you for having me and the Mycelial Network.
Amazing. And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find GASP online or email the mouthful that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
Try, and I try, and I try.